Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls. He liked thick giblet soup, nutty gizzards, a stuffed roast heart, liver slices fried with crust crumbs, fried hen cods rose. Most of all, he liked grilled mutton kidneys, which gave to his palate a fine tang of faintly scented urine.
That was a reading of the first paragraph of the fourth chapter of James Joyce's Ulysses, introducing the character of Leopold Bloom. It's also a pretty fair warning about what readers can expect to find in Ulysses if you're not put off by the literary equivalent of inner organs of beasts and fowls and delight in a slight tang of urine. Read on. Ulysses routinely shows up on lists of the greatest novels of the 20th century, frequently in the top spot, yet it remains one of the least read. The Lopate Book Club is inviting our listeners to read it with us, and joining us now to talk about it is Joyce scholar and distinguished university professor emeritus at Western University, Ontario, Michael Groden, who is also the author of Ulysses in Focus and Ulysses in Progress. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Is Joyce warning us that he'll make a literary meal of meats that many of us would call scrap and offal?
Well, Joyce wanted to write a book about one day in the life of a few people, and he wanted to include everything that would happen in that day.
So even in things like farting.
Even in things like farting and eating breakfast. So the first thing we meet at 8 in the morning when we meet Leopold Bloom is his breakfast.
But it also sounds to me like he wanted to make it a little difficult at time to read and very much in your face.
Yes, both. He immerses us in the life of these people so that we go through the day as they experience their day. And it's a day in Dublin in 1904. So unless we happen to be in Dublin in 1904, a lot of the details are going to be pretty strange.
Well, he wasn't in Dublin at the time. No. He was living in exile?
He was living in exile. He hadn't seen Dublin for 10 years when he started to write the book, for close to 20 when he finished, and had this extraordinary memory of the city he spent his first 20 years in.
Did he feel he had to leave Ireland to write this book?
I think he felt he had to leave Ireland to live and to survive as a writer and as a person. And then spent his entire life in exile writing about the Dublin he knew in his first 20 years.
And why did he feel he had to leave? He was already a celebrated writer. He'd written some great short stories and written a very popular novel, a lot easier to read novel.
But he wrote those books in exile as well. I think he felt that the oppression of the church, of his family, of the culture in Ireland, of the political power of England, just would make it unbearable for him to live in.
By writing some of these things, wasn't he inviting charges of obscenity? Did he expect to be censored or banned, at least in Ireland?
I think he probably knew he wasn't going to be read much in Ireland. What I don't think he expected was to be banned and censored and declared obscene in the United States, which is what did happen. And as a result, that made Ulysses a notorious book long before it was published as a book.
And it prevented it from being published in England as well,
yes,
because once it was declared obscene in the United States, the British didn't want to publish it. They saw it as a double whammy. Weren't printers,
yes,
the typesetters, and everyone else also considered culpable, mm-hmm, in an obscenity case in England?
Yes, they were. So that even if he had publishers who would have done it in England, but they couldn't get printers to touch it. So it was effectively banned in the U.S. and England, which also then meant Canada, Ireland, all the other countries that couldn't do it independently.
Do you think that he cared about the book being read by a lot of people being popular?
I think he did. And I think to some extent he had a kind of deluded idea that he was writing a popular book that everybody would simply pick up.
Interestingly, he felt that the Irish audience would not be his best audience. And yet, every time I've had an Irish writer on the show, they cite Joyce as one of their great heroes. So things have turned around totally.
Yes. And what's interesting about the situation in Ireland is that it really was a kind of effectively a banned book until the early 1970s, the late 1970s. In 1982, which was the 100th anniversary of Joyce's birth, Ireland decided to reclaim Joyce. And there were huge celebrations. All the books were reprinted with Irish editors and Irish writers doing the introductions. And suddenly Joyce became one of the major acknowledged writers in Ireland. So writers who have been writing since then are writing in the shadow of this huge colossus. Unlike in America, or in Europe, or in England, where they were starting to write in the shadow of Joyce from 1922 on. It took a while in Ireland.
How much of his Dublin was left by that time, and how much now? If I go to Ireland, am I still going to spot places in this book?
Little parts of it. In 1982, quite a bit of it was still there. Joyce said at one point that he wanted his picture of Dublin to be so complete that if it were destroyed, it could be recreated out of his book. And it did start to become necessary, but for the one reason that he probably never anticipated, which is that prosperity would destroy it. In the Celtic Tiger days, in the 90s and the early 2000s, a lot of buildings were turned down and replaced by modern skyscrapers.
How did it come to be published finally?
An American woman in Paris named Sylvia Beach, who ran an English language bookstore, heard him listen to his tale of woe about not being able to publish it and offered to do it.
So Shakespeare and Company published it. But were the French at all concerned, or did it help that this was a book that was in English?
It helped a lot.
If Beckett had written it in French, might it have run into trouble?
More so. Being published in England did a couple of things. It freed it from most of any worries about obscenity. It freed it from the libel laws, so that Joyce could name, as he does, he names people by their own names and says some quite unpleasant things about a lot of them. But because it was published in England, in France, I'm sorry, it was spared. He was spared any prosecution.
Something similar happens later with Henry Miller, also published in France. When and how in your life did you first encounter Ulysses? Was it love at first sight?
Yes, in a way. I took a course on the modern European novel during my sophomore year at Dartmouth College. It was taught by a professor named Peter Bean, and I'd been told to take it, that it was too great a course to pass up, and I had no interest in Ulysses. I just was told to take this course. I tried to read Ulysses during the summer before the course started, got through two chapters and the first five words of the third chapter of Stephen Dedalus thinking ineluctable modality of the visible. Okay,
I think that's what stopped me.
Yes, I get the sort of okay with visible, and I put it down. And it was the first book on the course in September, so the first lecture was on Stephen Dedalus's three chapters, which left me totally cold. And then in the fourth chapter, in the chapter that begins with the words we heard a few minutes ago, suddenly Leopold Bloom is introduced, and in ways that I still am trying to understand why it happened. I fell in love with it totally. And so at that point, it was love at first sight, and it lasted through the entire 3 weeks we read the book.
But did it help that you were reading it within a class situation where the structure was kind of imposed on you?
I think so, and it helped that I was being, I'm sure so, and it helped that I was listening to lectures by somebody who was leading us through the book. I don't know what I would have done on my own. I greatly admire and am in awe of people who have read the book on their own with understanding.
But as an academic, wouldn't you identify more with Stephen than with Leopold?
Yeah, you'd think so. And I was also 19, so sort of the same age about that Stephen is in Ulysses, and not 38 as Leopold Bloom is. And I didn't identify with him at all, and continued pretty much not to. It's always, for me, been a book about Leopold Bloom and Molly Bloom.
I've always seen it as a dividing line between the way people approach books. For some, the encounter with Ulysses is like an encounter with the sirens. You either tie yourself to the mast and pass on, or you become obsessed, go mad, and then wind up reading Finnegan's Wake over and over again for the rest of your life. And some people claim that reading James Joyce ruined reading other books for them.
It didn't for me. It did for quite a few years kind of color my sense of what a book should be. I think that changed when I got into my 30s and 40s. I do, since I teach it to student university students and to adults, I do that here at the 92nd Street Y and also in Toronto where I live. I'm quite fascinated by the ways people do read it, and they are what you say. I mean, some of them do read it and kind of go through it and let it pass by and then move on to the rest of their lives. Others get really, really hooked on it and get hooked in different ways at different places in the book. And, of course, they're all totally legitimate ways of reading and responding.
Well, when you read it, when you teach it annually at the 92nd Street, why? What kinds of classes do you have? They tend to be equally male and female? Do they tend to be younger or older or an even mix?
They used to be at least equally male and female or more male and female. This year it was very different. It was mostly female. They tend to be, because it's the 92nd Street Y and the people who take there, they tend to be middle-aged and up, which is wonderful for me to watch people read this book. Since I first encountered it when I was 19, I was 20 years younger than Leopold Bloom. To watch people reading it who are his age or older than him and coming at this book about this middle-aged man from their own sort of similar types of experiences or longer experiences, it's really fascinating.
So has the book changed for you when, because I'm sure you've reread it many times, did it change for you in middle age?
Yes, very much. I tried to think when I was reading it, you know, because people ask me, why do you like this so much? And I had some fairly simple answers about being a Jewish student reading about a Jewish man.
Although he's Jewish and not Jewish.
Not Jewish and not Jewish. But he was Jewish enough for me to sort of see him as somebody who, and he identifies himself as Jewish, so I thought of him that way. And I loved the kind of comedy of it and the humor of it and things like that. Later on, especially when I started to teach it in my middle age to adults, those people would often ask me why I was spending my whole life doing this kind of thing. And I really tried to get at what the appeal was of that book, enough that I've written a book about why it appealed to me. But I'm also interested in how it did change for me over my life, because when I became middle-aged, I started to think and try to ask myself, really, what was the appeal of this book? And a lot of it had to do with the interior monologue, with the thought processes that are presented.
And none of it has to do with the fact that your wife, who's a well-known poet, has been a guest on this show, is also named Molly?
Yes, well, I had a girlfriend in high school named Molly Peacock, and we broke up just after our freshman years at different colleges. And then 3 months later, I read Ulysses. I'm not sure whether it was part of the appeal or one of the obstacles I had to get over, that I'm reading a book with the name Molly on every page, over 600 or 700 pages. But then we re-met. We broke up, lost contact with each other completely, and re-met 20 years later and got married several years after that. So I've got two Mollies in my life now. And that too is one of the ways that my relationship to this book has changed very much, both to the book itself, but also to Molly Bloom. I mean, as a 19-year-old at an all-male college, I read Molly in somewhat the same ways as most of the characters in Ulysses see her, as the sexualized, almost animal-like being. By middle-aged, I was able to see her as a much more complicated kind of character.
Does it matter if a reader isn't familiar with the Latin Mass, can't speak Italian, doesn't know about Irish politics during this particular time?
Sort of everything you do and don't know will kind of make a difference in terms of what you read. Anybody will skip over or not catch a lot of things, especially on a first reading.
And does it matter?
Yes and no. I mean, and I think for the most part, no. I mean, for me, the Ulysses, despite all of its intellectual apparatus, all of the complications, all the difficulties, is about three people trying to get through their lives on one particular day. A married couple who are facing a crisis in their marriage, and a younger man who is totally unsure about what his future is going to be. The rest of it is partly the way Joyce set up the book and structured it, but if you get that part of it and follow that story through, what you get will be wonderful, and what you miss will not matter in a huge way.
My guess is Michael Groden, who is a Joyce scholar and distinguished university professor emeritus at Western University, Ontario, author of Ulysses in Focus and also Ulysses in Progress. And today's Leonard Lopate Book Club is the first of a three-part series on Ulysses. So we think this book not only deserves that amount of time, but also may inspire our listeners to start reading it and continue with us as we talk about it with other people. Edna O'Brien's going to be one of our guests talking about this, a writer who talks about how influenced she was by Joyce. So if you haven't read Ulysses, I hope that right now we are piquing your interest and you'll pick up a copy and start reading it, and stay with us for the next 3 months while we continue discussing it. We are back with our look at Ulysses with Michael Groden, who's written two books on Ulysses, Ulysses in Focus and also Ulysses in Progress. He is the Distinguished University Professor Emeritus at Western University in Ontario. Is there a Canadian take on this book? Or is this just... The reason I ask is, you know, on the one hand, this is very much an Irish novel. On the other hand, it's very much a novel for English readers in particular, because Joyce has so much fun with the language. And as you pointed out earlier, it's two books in another way. It's the human one and then the stylistic tour de force.
Yeah, and probably that makes reading in Canada probably isn't all that different from reading here. One of the things I would really recommend to people if they're trying to read the book and are stumped by a lot of the stuff is to listen to an audiobook of it, because you do get the accent.
Do you have a favorite reader?
No, there's three or four that I know of, and they're all very different from each other. So they all present different takes on it. The Irish Radio did one. An Irish actor named Jim Norton did one, and Donald Donnelly did one. The two big advantages I think of hearing it are that you do hear the voice that Joyce sort of wrote it in, and you can't stop, unless you stop the tape. You just keep going, and what you get, and what you miss, you don't.
As you pointed out, it unfolds over the course of one day, June 16th, now known as Bloomsday. How many years did it take him to write that one day?
About seven years.
He wrote it in chapter by chapter, kind of the way Dickens or Dostoevsky would have written a novel?
For the first 3 or 4 years, it was sort of consolidating in ways that we don't really know, because he didn't leave evidence of that. But then once Ezra Pound arranged for it to be published in a magazine in New York, the Little Review, then it started to come out chapter by chapter.
So he was writing it as it was already being published?
Yeah. It was being published before he was usually only one chapter ahead of the publication of it.
How much should we know about Homer's The Odyssey to understand Joyce's Ulysses?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. Of course, it's called Ulysses. He used The Odyssey as what he called a ground plan. His idea was to take Homer's story and use it as the structural basis for this novel, so that Homer's story starts with Telemachus and his mother, Penelope, waiting for Odysseus. They hope to come home. This one starts with a young man, Stephen Dedalus, whose mother has died but whose father is still around, wondering and obsessing over mothers and fathers. And then as the Odyssey then shifts to Odysseus trying to get home, we shift to Leopold Bloom, who's the Ulysses character in here. And he goes through a series of adventures or a series of experiences that all are modeled after parts of the Odyssey. In a way, you don't need to know much more than that, because you can go through the whole book without ever really knowing that this is based on the Odyssey.
There are major differences. For example, Ulysses, he is fighting very hard to get home to rescue his wife from a bunch of suitors who she's trying to fend off. In this case, Leopold leaves the house to allow Molly to have to be unfaithful to him.
And I think because Joyce obviously in one way was having fun with the way he was using the model and the way he was twisting it and turning it around. But I think he also, one of the things he is really, really concerned with is what makes a kind of heroic personal life in the 20th century. And one of the things has to do with how you relate to the person you are partnered with. And to the degree of control you expect to have over that person or the degree of freedom you grant to that person. And partly, I think one of the most interesting things to me is whether by the end of the book you actually can come to think that Leopold Bloom really is a version of heroic Odysseus. And Molly Bloom, unfaithful Molly Bloom, really is a version of Penelope. And if he can pull that off, that's quite an achievement.
Was there any significance to choosing June 16th as the date of the novel?
The legend is, and it might be true, that Joyce had met the woman he would eventually go on to spend his entire life with, named Nora Barnacle, a few days before that, and that June 16th is the first day that he actually went out walking with her, so that he wrote this book to... We don't know whether that's true or not, but it's a nice story.
Didn't Joyce resist calling the chapters chapters?
Yep.
Why?
One of the reasons that people have trouble with the book is that they don't follow the way chapters in a novel do. I mean, you get to the end of one, and then there seems to be a gap of a half an hour or an hour, and then you pick up a different story in a different place in the book. He never did refer them to chapters. He actually rarely referred to the book as a novel, so he called them episodes.
So were they meant to stand alone as unique episodes? Could a reader pick up one of them and read it without having read the previous chapter, want to call them?
The only problem with that is that they, especially in the beginning, they focus so much on Bloom's or Stephen's memory that he's remembering things that happened in the previous ones. So there's a way in which each one doesn't quite stand alone. They all are written in slightly different ways.
And different styles.
And when you get to the second half of the book, they're written in drastically different styles.
So part of the difficulty for a reader who's just trying to read this as a novel, that you don't settle into any rhythm?
No, and the problem is, or the fascination is, that when you kind of settle into one, he pulls the rug out from under you and starts something new. So I often describe it as being like on a roller coaster ride, where you're just going from one thing to another. And for some people, you know, they get lost in it or just get fed up with it. Other people, that becomes the entire fascination of the book, that what can he do next? By the time you get finished, he's pretty much told this story in almost every way you could tell a story at his time in the beginning of the 20th century.
Famously, Ulysses was found obscene, as you said. What particular chapter or what particular incident led to that decision?
There's a scene toward, it's in this, about halfway through the book, where Bloom is on the beach. He's tired. He's had a rough day so far. And he sees three young women who are out there with their little brothers. And one of them leans back to look at fireworks that are going off behind her. And as she leans back, she lifts up her skirt, and he gets to look up her skirt, which in 1904 is not that common thing to have happen, and he masturbates. And Joyce does this in an incredible paragraph where he describes fireworks going off all over the place. And in New York at the time, or in the U.S. at the time, to be considered obscene, all a court had to do was look at one particular passage and forget the context, and that's what they did.
Is it fair to say that by comparison to some of the later chapters, that episode is pretty tame?
It's pretty tame.
They didn't even bother getting to Molly Bloom.
No, which hadn't been written yet. And it's incredibly funny. And I think that probably Joyce did say to himself that, okay, if you think this was obscene, wait till you see what else I can do. And because parts of the book later on become much more graphic.
You have built a deep website to help your students navigate the text, which our listeners can also link to. And by the way, we have a link to the Irish radio version
of the
novel. What information do you provide to your students? You assume that they're going to read what you've said before they approach each chapter?
No. Not necessarily, and in a way it would probably be better not to. But I do
read it after the fact?
Yeah, I do try to ask questions about what they might want to think about. But I'm not sure if I want those... I mean, they can use it any way they want to, but I'm not sure I want them to be in their heads before they read it. I do give a little bit of information from the Odyssey, about the Odyssey, which I take from a wonderful reference book called Ulysses Annotated by Don Gifford and Robert Seidman, which fills out the gives you the translations of the words you don't know and identifies the places. It's a book-length series of footnotes. The challenge is to not overwhelm people with information, so that that becomes the, you know, that the information just smothers the book, but to give people what they find useful. And of course, that's different for different people. I needed to learn, and from footnotes, everything Joyce does with Catholicism, because I didn't grow up knowing anything about it. Catholicism is deeply embedded in everything Joyce writes, because his experience was entirely Catholic. Other people don't know that, but do need to know some of the Jewish things.
At one point, weren't you working on a CD-ROM project that incorporated the text and the references in one place? What happened to that?
Well, we couldn't do it because we needed the approval of the Joyce Estate and couldn't get that.
But I thought it was that court decided it was upset.
No, in this case. But what that told me, that's when I really, really became interested in how people read it and the different ways people read it. Outside of university classrooms and outside of lecture halls, because I really do want this to be a book that people try to read. I mean, it's difficult, but it's not impossible.
Well, it's so unorthodox. One chapter, chapter 14, consists of 40 individual paragraphs, each one a parody of different well-known writers throughout English literature, starting with Chaucer. And then there's a chapter that presents a complex theory of Shakespeare's Hamlet. So Joyce was throwing in
everything,
whatever he was thinking about at the time.
Yeah, that chapter with the 40 paragraphs is the one that really does in a lot of readers. It's halfway through the book. And unfortunately or fortunately, crucial things happen in that book, since the novel is bringing together Leopold Bloom and Stephen Dedalus as a kind of father-son figure, a pair. And that's where the recognition on Bloom's part actually happens. But it happens buried in the middle of a Middle English paragraph.
We're going to play something from Alec Baldwin from the book, but what kind of strategy can we give to our reading group to help them persevere?
Keep going. Keep looking for the human story. Keep trying. Keep appreciate the humor when you find it. Try to remember whatever you can. But the human story is the thing to keep going first. Without that, this isn't a book worth reading, as in my opinion.
Before we end, here is Alec Baldwin reading a list of Irish heroes from Ulysses. You instruct your students not to skip over Joyce's paragraphs that list items or people. Why not?
In the second half of the book, he starts to get more and more extreme in his experiments, and he starts to put in lists that are like some of the lists that happen in Homer. And I think this is the one that's going to be reading. It's a list of Irish heroes, but as you keep going on, the heroes become more and more comically Irish.
Well, let's listen.
From his girdle hung a row of sea stones, which jangled at every movement of his portentous frame. And on these were graven, with rude yet striking art, the tribal images of many Irish heroes and heroines of antiquity.
If you sign up for our newsletter, you will find out how we are breaking up this book to read it all together. Go to wmyc.org/bookclub. Ed O'Brien will be with us on April 6th. And we will also have some Facebook gatherings between now and then. So there are all sorts of different ways to approach it, including going to the link that we have online with the Irish radio version. So do you think people should read along with it?
Yes. That would
Open the book and listen.
To see it and to hear it would be ideal, to have both going on at the same time. It's a book to be read in print. I mean, you could do it online too, but I mean, Joyce wrote it knowing these words were going to appear on pages of a book. But it's also very oral in many, many ways. So
even more so is Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, yes.
Which also needs if you read it out loud, you realize you're just reading a string of puns.
Yeah. And if you see things, you don't often see those puns. I mean, he had an incredible ear for Irish spoken English, and then for other ways of speaking as well. But also this incredible facility with language and for playing around with it. I mean, I think for Joyce, words were like clay is to a sculptor, or the palette is to a painter. I mean, they were starting points for things that he could do, and I think he wanted to see what he could do without any real sense that there was a limit to what he could do.
A reminder to our listeners, if you sign up for our newsletter, you will find out how we're breaking the book up to read it all together. Go to wmyc.org/book club. And Edna O'Brien will be here on April 6th, as I said. So that's another reason. Thank you so much for being on our show. Michael Groton, University Professor, Distinguished University Professor Emeritus at Western University, Ontario.
Thank you.